It's Thursday, January 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, disagreement surfaces in addressing North Korea's nuclear test.
Whether or not he achieved the explosion of a hydrogen weapon is not what makes the difference. It's that he is trying.
We'll look at the World Freedom Report, who is coming to the UN-sponsored talks on Syria, and will travel across the United States without burning any gasoline. All that on today's International Edition. The United States and China agreed Wednesday to work together to ensure that North Korea ends its nuclear weapons program. But high-level talks in Beijing indicated that the two sides disagree on whether and what sort of sanctions to use against Pyongyang following its underground nuclear test 3 weeks ago. As VOA's Beijing correspondent Bill Ide reports, Secretary of State John Kerry, meeting with China's foreign minister in Beijing, stressed the North Korean issue is a high priority for Washington.
Talks between Secretary of State John Kerry and his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi lasted nearly 5 hours, well beyond what was scheduled. During the meetings, Kerry says the two agreed to accelerate efforts at the United Nations to curtail North Korea's nuclear ambitions and to issue a strong resolution in response to the latest test.
Kim Jong-un's actions are reckless and they are dangerous. Whether or not he achieved the explosion of a hydrogen weapon is not what makes the difference. It's that he is trying.
The two are still working out the parameters of what the resolution might say. Kerry says there are many different steps that can be taken that will not punish the North Korean people, including movement of ships, coal fuel, and border customs. China is North Korea's economic lifeline, and there are concerns Beijing will be reluctant to impose additional penalties on Pyongyang.
China's position is clear-cut, consistent, and reasonable. We reject any groundless speculation or distortion of China's position on North Korea.
Wang did not give any clues as to what actions Beijing might consider suitable as punishment, but he did say China would implement the entire resolution and not just parts of the agreement. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Sweden's human rights activist Peter Dahlin has returned to his home country after being deported from China and accused of endangering state security. The 35-year-old Dahlin is the co-founder of Chinese Urgent Action Group, which assists Chinese human rights lawyers with training and other support. He was detained earlier this month and last week was seen on Chinese state television confessing to the allegations. Patrick Poon is a China researcher for Amnesty International based in Hong Kong. He told my colleague Sarah Williams what this means for other human rights workers and members of non-governmental organizations in mainland China.
You can see how it is so alarming for other international human rights workers who are now doing advocacy work, in particular in mainland China, because what we could see Peter's organization in helping would be just like helping human rights activists, human rights lawyers, to go through, you know, the legal procedures to help the petitioners or those underprivileged to go through the legal framework within mainland China. So it's really legal for them to help those people. But then, like, the way it is now presented as the way the Chinese government tried to present them through the CCTV program, making Peter and, you know, some others also recently to confess in the official national broadcaster, can only see how the government in China is just trying to divert the attention to other allegations that has no reasonable grounds, but try to divert the attention on, you know, trying to make them confess instead of giving them any access to immediate access to lawyers. And in Peter's case, he actually was only given access to consular service because of the visits at the very end of his detention. So I mean, like, all this actually would have a chilling effect on the national human rights community working in China and also the mainland Chinese civil society as well. The government now is having a very hard line on cracking down on civil society in China, including human rights lawyers and these human rights activists and human rights workers in general.
And in this situation, in Peter Dullin's situation, he was detained along with his girlfriend, Pan Jinling, who is a Chinese citizen. Is it known her status?
I mean, like what we learned also in seeing public statements made by Peter and also Peter's colleagues is that Peter's girlfriend has been released, but she remains in China. So it's very worrying whether, you know, now she may not be allowed to go anywhere. It is very unclear about whether she could leave the country or not. And also now she also can't speak much. As we understand, it's difficult for Peter to talk about the case as well, because it's really the case that now they can not talk about the case. Otherwise, there may be some kind of revenge. I'm concerned whether it would be put on Peter's girlfriend if they talk too much, because the situation seems to be like that. But as far as we understand, it's now released, but remains in China.
And that seems to be the pattern with a number of these people who've been arrested or detained, that authorities, they have a relative or close friend, and so they're no doubt concerned about their loved ones.
I mean, like these tactics, we can see it's justified for us to suspect whether, you know, the government in China is using this as a way to silence critics.
That's Patrick Poon. He's a China researcher for Amnesty International, speaking from Hong Kong about the deportation of Swedish activist Peter Dullin from China. Coming up, Freedom House releases a report on the state of freedom in the world. Chris Simpkins will fill us in. This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. A new study suggests that global economic downturns and fear of social unrest led to increased political repression by authoritarian governments in 2015. As VOA's Chris Simpkins tells us, the 2015 report published by the nonpartisan group Freedom House rated the degree of democratic freedoms in nations around the world.
The civil war in Syria and instability elsewhere in the Middle East made the region one of the worst areas for freedom in the world. The 2015 Freedom House report says 72 countries experience conflicts, political and economic problems, which fueled a decline in global freedoms for the 10th consecutive year. Vanessa Tucker is an analyst with Freedom House.
We saw that in the various freedoms related to freedom of assembly, freedom of association, rule of law, the independence of the judiciary, really across the board, we saw deterioration in all of those areas.
Research by the Washington-based organization designates 50 countries and territories as not free. The worst offenders, the report says, were places like Syria. Others making the list were the Tibetan Autonomous Region of China, Somalia, North Korea, Uzbekistan, and Eritrea. The report indicates people in those places suffered significant setbacks as authoritarian leaders cracked down on rights activists and other critics. But according to the report, the Middle East and North Africa regions were ranked the worst.
And what we're seeing, particularly in the Middle East, is that a lot of the longtime rulers that have been in place and are even, in some cases, considered Western allies are actually are not stable partners and continuing to bank on them in the long run, I think, is a really bad bet.
Freedom House says democratic countries pressured by terrorist attacks and the strain caused by unprecedented numbers of migrants also clamp down on civil liberties.
So it's particularly important that in the countries that are facing the biggest challenges, which is almost all of them related to this wave of migration, that they continue to balance the government's duty to protect civilians and to protect national interest with the ongoing maintenance of basic freedoms.
Countries criticized by Freedom House often denounce the group. Russia has called the organization biased and accused it of serving U.S. interests. The report did find that 61 nations recorded progress in efforts to establish greater freedoms and cited Latin America for praise.
One major area was Latin America, and you saw in the past 5 to 10 years that there was a real crackdown on a lot of fundamental rights, and we've seen that trend is now reversing somewhat.
The report suggests the most significant setbacks to global freedom over the last decade have been in the areas of freedom of expression and the rule of law. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura sent out invitations to negotiations on the future of Syria Tuesday, but did not disclose who was on the list. The High Negotiations Committee contends it should be the sole opposition delegation, and while members have signaled a positive leaning toward the talks, their final decision has not been made public. Several other opposition figures who were not a part of the committee have said they were also invited, including Haitham Mana, a prominent opposition figure who is co-chair of the political wing of a Kurdish Arab alliance. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Nabil Khoury, a Middle East studies professor at Northwestern University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council.
Partly because of the argument over who represents the opposition, the opposition groups themselves are in disagreement to some extent. And then there is always the Assad regime and Russia, who may refuse, depending on what names are finally announced as being on the list. From the Syrian opposition's point of view, their concerns are legitimate, A, over the fact that they alone should determine their delegation to the peace talks, and B, that as a minimum, there should be a cessation of aerial bombardment and a relief on the sieges of cities where civilians are trapped and humanitarian aid is not getting to them. The American position, unfortunately, has been to say to the Syrian opposition, you must attend without any preconditions. The thing is that when you say you must attend without preconditions, that itself is a precondition. Nonetheless, there is some logic in deferring the discussion of some issues, such as the nature of the transitional government or a national coalition government, as the Russians have suggested. These are issues that could be deferred to later on in the negotiations, but to prepare the atmosphere for productive negotiations, you have to have some cessation of fighting, and you have to at least allow access to the besieged people to humanitarian assistance, truckloads of which are waiting in Syria to get to these people.
There are some key opposition forces that apparently have not been invited. One of them is the Kurdish PYD that Turkey insists it does not want to be part of this process.
It's the Russians that are making a point of inviting the Kurdish Democratic Party. It is obvious that they are doing this to irk the Turks, with whom they've had a running feud over the shooting down of the Russian jet fighter. Russia would rather not have Turkey involved at all. The thing is that, again, it comes back to the Syrian opposition they should decide whether to include the Kurds or not. Should the Kurds attend and Turkey opt out, that would not be a major loss. It would be unfortunate, but it would not be a major loss.
Nabil Khoury is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He says as various opposition groups and individuals jockey for position at the talks, the Syrian regime, backed by Lebanese Hezbollah fighters and Russian airstrikes, continues to make progress in solidifying battlefield gains in an area from the Turkish border in the north to Jordan in the south. We're joined now by Michael Lippin, our social media reporter. Wednesday was a very solemn day. It marked the 71st anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camps. Michael, how were people marking that occasion, and what did they say on social media?
Well, this is a very special occasion. It's January 27th, designated by the United Nations General Assembly each year as an International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The UN uses this occasion to honor those who were murdered by Nazi Germany, namely 6 million Jews and several million other people who were also targets of Nazi persecution, such as minority Roma. Now, Auschwitz was definitely a popular search term on Twitter today. Besides hashtag Auschwitz, people on Twitter were using hashtags like hashtag Auschwitz Liberation and hashtag Holocaust Remembrance. Well, here in Washington, Remembrance Day was marked with a ceremony at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. One of the speakers was German ambassador to the United States, Peter Wittig, and this is what he had to say.
We're living at a time where Europe and at its center, Germany, is experiencing a refugee crisis of unprecedented proportions. In these times of change, where our Jewish citizens increasingly fear renewed anti-Semitism, our message is simple and resolute. Anti-Semitism has no place in Germany.
Well, you can find German Ambassador Wittig on Twitter. His handle is @AMBWITTIG. He's also encouraging people to say how they are remembering the Holocaust by using the hashtag IRememberBy and then saying what action you're taking. One other hashtag that I saw people using is hashtag MemoryToAction. So clearly an effort by many people to spur action from remembering the Holocaust.
Michael Lippin, thank you very much. You can listen for Michael's segments every day on International Edition. You can also hit him up on Twitter. He's @Michael_Lippin. That's LIPIN. And you can send us a tweet. We're @VOA_IE. Coming up, Shelley Schlender takes us across the United States without burning any gasoline. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Here in the United States, gas stations are everywhere. But when it comes to electric cars, finding a place to charge up can be a real concern. Along with the price, that's one of the things that's keeping Americans tethered to their high-polluting gasoline-powered cars. But Shelley Schlender reports that those days are changing, and a cleaner driving future might soon be coming to a town near you.
Blue skies and an open highway are a driver's dream, but driving means burning fossil fuels, and those emissions are driving climate change. Electric cars are cleaner, but charging up on the road has been a challenge. However, as more Americans buy Teslas, Leafs, and other all-electric cars, it's getting easier to find charging stations. There are several in the parking lot of a luxury Colorado shopping center. The parking lot attendant calls these sleek oval electric charging stands a bargain.
We give you 1 hour free to Charge your Tesla.
In Kansas, after driving down a country road surrounded by sunflowers and growing crops, Tesla drivers can power up for free at a Holiday Inn, like Neil Belmore, who taps the hood of his shiny black Tesla to get his son's attention.
What charge level are we at? 150 yet?
163.
Oh, so we can go, yeah.
He and his son are driving all electric, all the way from Toronto to California.
He's a very fast Tesla driver, I have to say. Makes me nervous.
After just 30 minutes, the Belmore's battery-powered Tesla rolls silently back onto the nearby interstate highway with enough power to go another 240 kilometers, plenty to reach the next supercharger. These stations are popping up along superhighways around the world. Internet maps display the expanding network. The Tesla's talking computer guides drivers to the nearest one, which in this case is a small town in Arizona.
In 0.1 miles, turn left onto West Yavapai Street.
Forward-thinking families pull into Golden Real Estate in Colorado to take advantage of the free charge-ups Jim Smith offers to any electric car. Also in Smith's parking lot are shiny solar panels, so he gets plenty of clean power from the sun.
We want to save the planet from global warming and from wasteful use of energy. And we also want to eliminate our dependence on foreign oil.
U.S. Nissan dealers offer a free fast charger called a CHAdeMO. As a woman in a cowboy hat finishes charging up her all-electric Nissan Leaf, Boulder Nissan's Nigel Zeed tells her that many campgrounds and homeowners offer charging stations that drivers can find on the internet through PlugShare.
So once you sign in to PlugShare, you can see all the people's homes and you can contact them, and they leave little messages like, well, if you want to charge and I'm not there, you know, this is a code to the garage, or here's my cell phone number, or text me, because
it's a community.
It is a community.
That cowgirl is Hunter Levins, a world-renowned promoter of sustainable development. Levins not only owns an electric car, she charges its batteries through solar panels right in her own backyard.
The easy thing about this Leaf is I simply plug it into the wall. Today, on a nice sunny day, the sun is charging my Leaf. When the sun goes down, there's a battery bank over there, and that charges the Leaf.
While solar panels, charging stations, and electric cars are currently expensive, Levin says their costs are dropping so fast, they might someday outnumber not only gas-powered cars, but hybrid vehicles that can run on both gas and electricity.
Just as people in remote areas are leapfrogging straight to cell phones from no phone, they'll go from no car to electrics rather than an intermediate step through hybrids.
As for filling stations, Levin says that if they continue to focus on fossil fuels, they might become dinosaurs. Driving by one of her former favorite gas stations, Levin shakes her head.
I used to be a regular customer over there at Boulder Gas, and I would stop in and say hi to the guys behind the counter and buy something to eat and fill up my car. Haven't been in there since I bought the Leaf.
Levin suspects that gas stations will soon feature electric charging stations next to traditional fuel pumps. And someday soon, she hopes most will be mostly electric. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender, Boulder, Colorado.
Could have used some of those electric cars when the gas lines were real long here in Washington during the recent snowstorm. Well, researchers at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine say that young adults who often use social media are more likely to suffer sleep disturbances than those who use social media less. According to the findings, doctors should be asking young people about their social media use when treating sleep disorders. Researchers say that social media can influence sleep patterns in a variety of ways, including leading people to lose sleep by staying up too late checking on social media. It can also cause emotional, cognitive, or physiological arousal over a contentious issue argued about on social media and interfering with natural circadian rhythms because of the light coming from cell phones or computer screens. Now, for this study, researchers gave questionnaires to 1,788 young adults between the age of 19 and 32 to find out how much they used social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, Histogram, Snapshot, Credit, Tumblr, and others. What they found was that on average, participants used social media 61 minutes a day and visited various sites about 30 times per week. 30% of those studied reported serious sleep disturbances. A team of American, British, and Australian astronomers has discovered the largest solar system ever found. Researchers say the planet, known as two-mass J212, and once thought to be a free-floating or lonely planet, is actually in orbit about 1 trillion kilometers from its star. That is about 7,000 times farther than the Earth is from the Sun, and 140 times larger than the orbit of the dwarf planet Pluto. The lead author, Niall Deakin of the University of Hertfordshire in England, said the planet is not quite as lonely as researchers first thought, but it's certainly in what he called a long-distance relationship. At that distance, the planet orbits its star about once every 900,000 years. While it's doubtful the planet hosts life, if it did, the residents would see their sun as just a bright star and might not even imagine that they were connected to it at all. Two-mass J2126 was found 8 years ago by U.S. researchers in an infrared sky survey, which caused them to classify it as young and likely of a relatively low mass. Later, Canadian researchers discovered the planet was a possible member of a 45-million-year-old group of stars and brown dwarfs known as the Tucana Horologium Association. Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. We welcome your questions or comments. You can follow us on Facebook at VOA Asia. On Twitter, we're at VOAIE. You can also visit our website. That's voanews.com. Tracy Carter directed our program today. Dave Magnus was our engineer. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and/or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303. USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.